we spent a lot of time really exploring the problem space of like, how do you run like development tool chains in a browser? Because there was really not any meaningful prior art on that before we came around. Mm-hmm. And even today, like we've got the most domain knowledge on this stuff, I think probably compared to anyone else on the planet, simply because it's what we're in the business of. And so we, you know, it took us 2 years of that R&D where we had this kind of aha moment where we're like, oh, it actually should be possible for us to punch in a layer lower here than at this, the higher level kind of bundler runtime level. We can actually punch in more at an OS level, run node.
Hello, welcome to DevTools FM. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Everyone, we're really excited to have Eric Simmons on today. So Eric is the CEO of StackBlitz. Have really admired StackBlitz for a long time. Y'all do some really, really cool stuff. So Eric, it's just an absolute pleasure for us to have you on. Before we start talking about your past and some of what you're doing at StackBlitz, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Big fan of your guys' podcast. And yeah, a little background on me. So I'm the co-founder and CEO of StackBlitz. It's an instant web-based IDE for front-end development teams. And you might have seen it if you've ever browsed like doc sites for, you know, Angular or React, Material UI, things like that, where it says like run live example. Like that's a lot of those use StackBlitz for those sorts of things. And I started this company with actually one of my childhood best friends. He and I have been building software together for the past decade and a half. So like when we were 13, we learned how to write web applications, and just we've been building stuff ever since then. So StackBlitz is kind of, it's you know, the we started StackBlitz like 6-7 years ago now, I think. And just as a side project, really blew up into this larger thing than it is today. But Albert and I have always kind of viewed it's a thing that we wish we had when we were 13 learning how to code, you know, not even to set up our local environments. It's such a pain. But anyways, yeah, so that's kind of a quick background on me.
Yeah.
We'd like to thank Rickcast for sponsoring this week's episode. Rickcast is an app for Mac that's like Spotlight, but with superpowers. Besides just quickly opening files, URLs, or apps, it provides clipboard history, window management, schedule overview, and more. It's got a clean React-based API and an extension store to distribute your own custom extensions. I've been using the Rickcast extension API to make a TL draw extension so I can quickly create and save TL draw canvases for ideation or planning. I've also used Raycast deep linking feature to create a link in my Obsidian setup to quickly open some of my TL draw boards. So with custom keyboard shortcuts, an extension store, deep links, quick links, all of the features I provide, it's a really flexible tool that's indispensable in my workflow. Raycast also has a Teams feature where you can share extensions, snippets, and quick links with your teammates. You should also check out Raycast Pro. With Pro, you can take advantage of Raycast AI to summarize text in any app and translate text on the fly. It also gives you access to their cloud sync features to keep your settings synchronized across Macs. To learn more, you can visit raycast.com or check out episode 38, where we talked to Thomas, the CEO, about Raycast and how they built it.
Before we get into the StackBlitz stuff, the way I was alerted to your existence was you were trending on Twitter because of kind of a crazy event in your past. So why were you at AOL for so long?
Yeah, so for those who, I imagine a lot of people may not have heard the story, but so back like 10 years ago, this is like, I think in 2012, there was this kind of headline that was like going around the world on, you know, front page of newspapers and whatever have you about this you know, teenager that illegally like lived in AOL's headquarters bootstrapping his startup. And that guy was me. So I think I was like 19 at the time. And so I guess there's a little bit of a callback here. So like I'd mentioned, you know, my co-founder Albert and I, like we had met, you know, when we were, you know, 13, learned how to code together. And right out of high school, he and I decided to go and do startups. And we grew up in a suburb of Chicago. And at least back then, there was really nothing as far as software and startups in Chicago, at least nothing like the Bay Area. So we were pretty dead set on coming out here. But we, you know, we were like broke, 18-year-olds. And the reason we ended up at AOL actually was because we went through this program called Imagine K-12, which was a Y Combinator offshoot for K-12 education companies. So Albert and I were working on this like K-12 software collaboration platform. And I think Imagine K-12 has actually been pulled back into Y Combinator itself now. But anyways, they were actually renting office space out of AOL. Because at that time, AOL was like trying to reinvigorate the company and kind of turn things around. And so they wanted to get like entrepreneurial people and like, you know, really great software people just in the same offices as their employees to you know, kind of have this kind of cross-pollination. And so I ended up with an access card to AOL as a result of that, because our incubator was kind of based out of there. And you could use that to get it at any time of the day or night. Their offices were pretty sweet, as you know, as an 18-year-old, and you know, quality of living bar pretty much non-existent. You know, they have tons of couches. They had a gym which had showers and a laundromat. Like there was like, you know, food that you could eat and stuff. So, I mean, I think that it's been a long time now, but I mean, I'm pretty sure. I think that I lived on $1 a month when I was there, and I ended up being there for I think like 4 months or something like that. It was just like ridiculous. And so that was that, and I ended up bootstrapping that. You're kind of bootstrapping our way through that period. And then we were able to raise like a little bit of money and you know, continue our company. But anyways, that the story kind of broke and it was like this global headline, et cetera. But yeah, that's like these days I've you know, back then it was like that was the only thing I was known for. And today it's like it's kind of funny because people are like, oh, I've heard of Stack Blitz. I didn't know you were that guy from 10 years ago. It's like, yeah, it's not something I'm trying to advertise, right? But yeah, it's kind of fun. Like that's not what I wanted my tombstone. I was like, this is like the kid that lived at AOL, blah, blah, blah. You know? So, but anyways, yeah, so it's kind of a fun story.
Yeah, it's fun when you are like part of tech history memes. Like at the old company I worked at, Intuit, one of the VPs was Brent Rambo, the kid who does this, like the thumbs up at a computer. And just like, I would love to have that as a part of my history. when did it start to break down? Like, when did people notice, like, who is this kid? Like, what team does he work on? Why is he here?
You know, I don't know. And then, cause it, you know, I got away with it for so long because, you know, they had like two or three different shifts of guards. And so like the morning folks were like, you know, just seeing me there grinding, like, yeah, this guy works hard. And then the evening people were like, you know, wow, this guy looks hard. He, you know, works hard. The overnight people were like, wow, this guy really works hard. But so it took a while for the dots to connect. They're like, do you see this guy a lot, you know, around here? I still don't know exactly what happened with that, like how exactly they kind of lasered him. But it was pretty clear, like the day that they kicked me out, it was like I'd been like coding until 2 or 3 in the morning. And because at that time I was literally just, you know, writing like, you know, 16 hours a day worth of code. It's just something like ridiculous, if not more. I don't know where I had the energy. It's like now I'm like 32. I'm like, I there's no way I could do that at this point. But back then, just infinite energy as an 18 or 19 year old. And, but I've been coding till like three or four in the morning or something like that. And, I was like in this room with like a couch in it, and I heard these footsteps just coming down the hallway, and it was like, it just came straight, like, cause there's no one in the office. So like it echoed through the entire floor, and it just came, this guy came straight to the room I was in and opened the door and just started yelling at me and then like threw me out of the building. And so it was pretty clear that like, he knew I was in there. Like I don't know how it came to be, but like he knew exactly where to go to find me, and came in and just threw me out. But yeah, anyway, so I don't know. It's still a mystery to me to this day.
Yeah. I'd love to hear the other side of that story. I can literally imagine like a Seth Rogen style movie where you have like a Paul Blart mall cop type. He gets this like intuition that something's going on in the building. I can see the movie now. You should option off the rights. I think you got something there.
Well, it was pretty, so I think it was, you know, the security team was not happy about it, obviously, because I think it didn't look maybe good on them or something like that, even though it was like, you know, it wasn't, you know, I don't think there was a lot of fault on their end, but the executive team about AOL was legendary, because the way that they were, because I mean, at that time when the story broke, there was some concern around the legality of what had happened, and like, you know, everything from like, are they going to, you know, press charges on trespassing or something? Are they going to like, you know, try and claim IP ownership of the code you were writing? They're like, there's all these questions that came up, right? But they were actually just in like the response was incredible. Like the quote is when some, like what they gave to the press, the quote that they ran with for the story was, you know, we our intention was always to like facilitate entrepreneurship at our Palo Alto office. We just never expected it to work so well. Just like such a great response, you know, from the marketing and the PR team there. And it was like a bullet dodge, you know, for me at that time. But yeah, they were actually pretty cool. I actually ended up meeting within a week of that. They called me into the office and I met the guy who actually provided the quote. I think his name's David Temkin, and he, super nice guy. I think he's running mail or something at AOL at that time. But, you know, I sat down with him and he was like very, you know, he's like, you've got Moxie, like, sounds like you're doing good stuff. But you know, don't do this again. Like don't come back. But they are super nice to the degree that, you know, that, you know, we all left on good terms or whatever.
That's such a wild story. So I'm also curious about like what you were working on during time. Like, how did that product go? Like, did you have investors? Were there like people that you're like at AOL like during the day and like at night, and then you like go meet your investors somewhere, like, or are they asking about your living conditions? I don't know. I'm just so fascinated.
Yeah. I mean, so it's at that time we had only like gotten, like, back then it was the original kind of YC deal where they give you like 20K and you burn through that in like 3 or 4 months, right? Which we did. And that's how I ended up at AOL, is that I was like, dang, we need some more time. And so the software, we were pretty passionate about the education space. And so at that time we were working on this thing called Class Connect that basically was like, it's like GitHub for teachers, where effectively like every teacher was like writing their own lesson plans and no one was sharing this stuff. And it just makes no sense even to this day. Right. And so we ended up kind of creating this thing that solved that problem. And, you know, kind of as we were going through the program, and when you go through one of these incubators, I mean, and just in investments in general, you're a number on a spreadsheet. Typically. I mean, like, they're going to, not saying that, that they don't provide you with great, high quality advice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really kind of like, you know, it's very unusual, I guess, to have people that are really, really staying on top of like, hey, does Eric have a home? You know, to that degree, right? Like, that's, you know, no one was really, they were just, you know, like, he's somehow around, I guess, you know, he's kind of giving updates and whatever, you know, but yeah, so that product was actually, if you want to like get brutalized in entrepreneurship, you go and start a K-12 company, anything in K-12. It's like, it is the absolute worst market. And people had told me this going into it, but I was like 18 and just, you know, extremely naive and whatever. And so basically like where we decided to stop going after K-12 was, you know, we needed to generate revenue. And so that means like selling to schools and that sort of thing. Right. And we had a lot of teachers that were like pretty, you know, avid users of our platform and whatever have you. But, you know, if you're going to do sales, it's kind of K-12 sales looks very similar to enterprise sales, except way more insane, like, and way more expensive for the reasons that'll be obvious after I tell like this quick story. But basically, we got one of the top sales guys for Blackboard, which is, you know, I believe they're like a public company, one of the biggest K-12 or, you know, et cetera, software things. You might have used it if you ever, you know, in high school or college or something like that. Terrible software. It's ugly. Just worst software ever. They have the a well-oiled sales machine. Like, that is, Blackboard is a sales company, not a software company. And so we were going to poach one of the top sales guys there. And he's like, and we're like, okay, how does this, what would this like look like, you know, to do this? And he's like, great. So we're going to have to out-party Blackboard. We're like, okay. I mean, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean to out part of it? He's like, okay, well, the way that Blackboard does sales every year is they invite, and this is like kind of a direct quote. So like, I'm going to use the exact phrasing that this guy said to us at that time. He said, you know, every year Blackboard invites all of the top superintendents across the country and to an aircraft carrier that we rent from the US Navy. And we throw a giant party with booze and babes over a weekend. These superintendents come with a blank check and they leave without a check. And that's how these schools decide to use Blackboard every year. And we were like, what? Like, that's, you know, our software is better. Like, you know, they should, you know, it's like, it's more cost effective, right? Like, that's, yeah. This is like, it's better for the kids. It's better for the teachers. You know, it just, it didn't matter. It does not matter. right? So if you ever wonder why, like, you know, your school software like sucks, it's like, as with many things in many types of systems in life, it's like the further the person making the actual purchasing decision is from the person actually like using the thing that's being purchased, the experience of that thing tends to be worse proportionally to the number of layers between you and the purchase maker, right? And in K-12, it is a lot of freaking layers, right? So that's, we were like, all right, K-12, it ain't it. Like, what do we do here? And so this actually kind of ties into how we started Stacklets, because we ended up pivoting into developer education, because this is back in 2012, 2013. So this is AngularJS was coming on the scene. This is like a year or two before React kind of started becoming a thing. And so we ended up creating this, like, it was just like a blog called Thinkster.io. And we ended up having like the tutorial on AngularJS and all things Angular. And then we added React as well. And so we were running that from 2012 or 2013 through 2017, 18, I think. And it became rather popular, had a couple hundred thousand people using it. And we are kind of similar model to like EGA.io or like Lynda or Pluralsight, where you come, like, we had a whole bunch of free content, but then you could also pay a monthly subscription to access, you know, all this content on, you know, building basically the cutting edge of web applications. And the biggest problem we started running into was that during that transition, back in the, you know, mid 2010s, of going from, like, you know, when it was AngularJS, you were just putting like script tags and stuff, but then things started shifting where you needed to use a build tool like Webpack and et cetera, et cetera. And the problem is that if you're going to teach that stuff, you can't use CodePen anymore, because CodePen is just an HTML file, a JavaScript file, and a CSS file. That's it. Like, you can't, there's no NPM, there's no whatever, right? Maybe they've kind of added some stuff now, but even now it's like, you really can't do a lot of the things that you need to do. And that, it kind of hit us. We were like, oh, you know, if we want to have these live examples, like, it should be possible to actually run like a little mini version of Webpack and a little mini version of NPM in a browser tab, like not running on some server, right? Because like all these cloud IDs in the past, it's like every person that comes, like if you open a Cloud9 or GitHub Codespaces link, it's, your browser's not really doing anything. It has to go and provision a VM in the cloud. Usually that means putting in a credit card, or it's like super slow, or like, you know, if it's free, usually they give you like 128 megs of RAM, which you like can't really do much with. We were like, it would be very interesting if you could actually just run it in the browser tab, though, using the user CPU and memory, because there's no cost on our side of it. It'd be super fast, et cetera. And so we looked around, no one had done this. And Albert and I have always been suckers for a good challenge. And we spent 6 months building the first prototype, and we launched it. And it kind of from day one took off like a rocket. And so that was actually the impetus of Stacklets, kind of in this long story here, is we built it because people on Thinkster were just couldn't even learn React, because they're like, hey, my React says I'm out of file watchers. We're like, that's like not a React thing, you know? anyway, so that's kind of the origin of where Stacklets came from. And so to kind of wrap that part of the story is, you know, Stacklets started growing really quickly. And Albert and I were like, oh crap. Like we ended up running two companies at the same time. It was just him and I, you know, like Thinkster, this thing we had bootstrapped, and Stacklets, this thing that we were, you know, bootstrapping as well. And so we ended up selling Thinkster off so that we could focus on Stacklets full time. And that's kind of where we've been, you know, since 2018. So anyways, that's kind of the long story long of how this came to be.
No, that's an interesting journey. So I know, like, today we have like web containers, and like we'll get to that, and those are cool, interesting technology. But like in the time frame you described, like sounds like it was before web containers. So did that initial version of Stacklets like do something else to get all that stuff running in browser?
Yeah, it did, and because we hadn't. It was, we kind of punched in at a higher level than, because web container punches in at a really at the almost the operating system level to run this stuff in the browser. So like when you go to Stacklets today, you can actually like run commands in a terminal and like run the git CLI and like, you know, type node and, you know, actually get into the node REPL or install NPM package. So you had like a full programmable CLI, the first version of Stacklets was really just like a very hacked up version of, like, it, to be very specific, we took System.js, which was like an in-browser bundler runtime thing, and we hacked it basically to work with Webpack loaders, kinda. And then we basically did, to get NPM working, we wrote a whole bunch of things that it was kind of similar to like unpackage, but we basically kind of bolted it into the system.js/, you know, Webpack Loader Bundler thing. It was just basically this like custom welded thing that just allowed you to emulate how Create React App or the Angular CLI or these things would work, but it wasn't them. Like, it was not Create React App or the Angular CLI or these things under the hood. It just mimicked the exact heuristics of how those things would work, which it was very fast because it's custom welded. It was an extremely fast solution, like from a performance perspective. But the problem that we were running into was that people were often trying to do these like advanced things where they're trying to like eject out of Create React App, or like they're trying to use some loader that we didn't have supported. And then also there's this trend that is, you know, even more in full swing now towards kind of full stack SSR or SSG sort of stuff, right? Like Next.js or Astro or whatever. And that's kind of where, you know, we had learned a ton. So from 2017, we launched through 2019. So like, I guess like 2 years, you know, we spent a lot of time really exploring the problem space of like, how do you run like development tool chains in a browser? Because there was really not any meaningful prior art on that before we came around. Mm-hmm. And even today, like we've got the most domain knowledge on this stuff, I think, probably compared to anyone else on the planet, simply because it's what we're in the business of. And so we, you know, it took us 2 years of that R&D where we had this kind of aha moment. We're like, oh, it actually should be possible for us to punch in a layer lower here that at this, the higher level kind of bundler runtime level, we can actually punch in more at an OS level, run Node.js on top of that, and you just run native package managers on top of that, run your native tool chains on top of that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We had a lot of conviction in that because it was actually a story we had seen happen before. Like back when we were in the, you know, first came to the Valley back in 2012, 2013, we had ran into Dylan Field, one of the co-founders of Figma, and that was kind of effectively their thesis back then. Was like, you know, the demo they went and raised some money on, the initial money was like they had a WebGL demo with like a ball falling into water. Like it was not a design tool. It was like, here's a demo that WebGL WebAssembly is a pretty big deal, right? Right at that time it was like ASM.js or whatever. Be like, here's a demo of why this is a pretty big deal. Why it can be used to build a design tool, like why this is going to allow design to come to the browser when it has never been able to do so before. Give us money to go do R&D for a year or two on this technology so we can ship this thing. And that's really where Figma started, was this deep technology bet on WebGL and WebAssembly. Once they really perfected that technology, they actually added the productivity collaboration aspects kind of around the ability to do rendering like that in a browser engine. And that's kind of what we saw with WebContainer. We were like, oh shiz, like this is the first time, really almost like the first millisecond of time where you could actually even begin kind of talking about building something like that realistically, just because of the advent of the very specific browser APIs that hadn't been there before. And so we ended up taking, you know, 2019, we brought on Dominic Elm, and he was the first hire to work on WebContainer. He built that project and, you know, really founded that thing, and then ended up hiring on a couple other folks. And then through 2021, which is when we launched it publicly. And since then it's been like publicly available, people are using it, et cetera. But, anyways, yeah, so that's kind of like the evolutionary story of kind of how WebContainer came to be, and kind of really, I mean, in a sense, the existential bet, of that Stackblitz made, you know, as a company that it had ended up panning out. And I mean, that story is continuing to unfold.
Yeah, the previous strategy must have been a whole lot of work. And there's like obviously a ceiling there of complexity that you're going to hit where it's like, well, it's just like there's a lot of things you can do. We can't really support all of those. But like with web containers, were you basically able to go, okay, just kind of delete all that and it's just web containers now?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And it was like, it was extremely unclear if it would work too, right? So like it was like, because it was very clear to us, if we couldn't make web container work, there... What we felt was really compelling and really interesting here, you know, about what we were doing versus kind of what everyone else has ever done in the cloud or web IDE sort of space. It had to work for this to make sense, to be a business, a meaningful, like to be a startup, like something that had high growth potential and could like actually change how we do things. Right. And, back when we first raised our seed round 2019, we had extremely smart people that work on browser engines that were like, I don't think that I get it. I don't know if you're going to be able to do it. it's one of these things where you can kind of look at a mountain from afar and like analyze it and kind of get the right gear they think you're going to need to climb it. But ultimately it's like the question of, can you climb it? You only get to know the real answer by strapping on and doing it one way or the other. And so that's kind of where we ended up with web containers. Like we got to a point where we had extremely high conviction, raised some money from investors that took a pretty non-consensus bet, I would say, on certainly at that time on what we were up to, ended up panning out. I completely forgot the question you asked me though. I went on a tangent to add some color and now I forgot.
No, it's fine. I resonate with your words. I work at a company called Descript and we're making a very similar bet on web codecs. Like we are like at the forefront of that technology and like literally like awaiting releases from Apple. So it's a fun space to be in. One thing I wanted to note before we move on to more questions is, when I would looked at your guys' pricing page, I was like kind of surprised. It feels like very low to me. And I think that low price comes from like the local nature of the product, right?
Yeah, effectively. I mean, I think that's one of the great things about our model is that we don't have to charge you by the minute and we're able to leverage your local hardware. So like we can charge us more like a SaaS subscription for that you would expect from, I don't know, like something like Figma or something like that, right? Like, or Google Docs. You can kind of, the cost model is the same, you know? So we can actually kind of leverage that to give a very transparent, like, pricing model. Like, one of the things that, from a marketing side that we've been kind of kicking around is like, you kind of think of it like when you're buying a Stacklet subscription, you're buying, unlimited compute minutes effectively, right? Whereas, when you kind of look at these other things, it's like they give you, you're either getting like buying like, $50 worth of X number of minutes, or it's you're paying by the minute. And it's just, it doesn't make sense either. Cause this is one of the things too, that we a couple of years ago, back in even until 2021, there was not a lot of belief that Moore's law was going to keep up. Cause like x86 architectures were just kind of struggling. And so a lot of, I don't think it's controversial to say that the consensus take at that time was that workloads were going to need to move to the cloud. Then you saw this with things like Mighty and Stadia and blah, 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 where they kind of gave up on your end device compute becoming faster in any meaningful way. And they're like, okay, everything's going to have to go to the cloud and be rendered there, even like your browser and gaming and whatever. But what happened is, I mean, Apple, I think single-handedly kind of proved like, nope, like we can ship ridiculously fast stuff, to end clients. And and it's smoking the stuff that's sitting in data centers today. So there's kind of this interesting situation going on where like you buy a MacBook, right? And it's got, state-of-the-art ARM-based chipsets that's way faster than what's going to be in, you connect to an AWS or whatever, for the same price point at least. And, so if you're like a company, it's like, wait, we're buying a $2,000 MacBook that's crazy fast. Why are we going to pay by the minute for like x86 things that are slower, than what you can get at local? So I think there's kind of this transition back to, okay, wait a second, like client side is actually, the consensus view that client side compute was going to go away seems to be reversing, at least in the kind of immediate term. But I mean, I think it's incredible. I mean, the yearly releases Apple's doing in particular, where does it end? How many more years are we going to see of that? I think the answer is like quite a few more. I don't think this is a temporary state of affairs we're in. So anyways, blah, blah, blah. But like that's, I think that was another important part here of like something that's actually changing right now. Like this has now become like the consensus view. But like for us, this is like, this is kind of what we had felt, was likely to be the case back 4 or 5 years ago.
It's likely that you also benefit from the fact that like a lot of customers using Stackblitz are probably developers or like, have beefier machines likely. I mean, just giving a tech product, even if it's like educational in nature, or, you know, sort of can facilitate that use case, I'm sure that you kind of benefit from some better client support there. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is just like feature coverage a little bit. So I had contributed to Code Sandbox back in the day. It's been a while, but I think I like added like pug support or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember the interesting thing about Code Sandbox is it was probably like somewhat similar to your pre web container model, and that like they just had loaders running in web workers, and that was sort of like they just distributed a bunch of stuff in web workers, and you know, you had to write a lot of manual glue code and like rewrite a lot of loaders and do this stuff so it like supported the language. So it was never as simple as just like, oh, this new thing came out and now we support it. Because like, as you know, the front end world in particular moves so daggum fast that there's like always something new coming out, like always a new compile to language or, you know, build tooling or whatever else. So I'm curious, in the new world where you're using web containers, is the sort of notion of language support, is that even something that you're really thinking of like as a first class thing, or do you just like, does that just come by the nature of just like having web containers, or like how much extra work do you have to do in that?
Yeah, great question. And so specifically, like language support for us is largely a question of like, how well do these languages, like the compilers or runtimes of these languages, compile to WebAssembly, right? And so the answer for that just continues to get better year over year. So like back when we were, you know, back 2 years ago, the answer was not a lot. today, the answer is like, we've got the first ecosystems coming online now for other languages. So one, you know, probably the most fully featured example of this would be PHP and WordPress. And like when we first saw WordPress come online, we were like, WordPress like that, you know, what, you know, but it's, you know, WordPress powers, I think, you know, like 40% of the internet or something. It's just kind of it's ridiculous. Like you know, and it's been around for, you know, what, like two decades, something like that, you know, like 15, 20 years, something. So this is not like a greenfield thing. Like this is something with a lot of history and, backwards compatibility, et cetera. And they've got their entire thing running in, you know, in WebAssembly and Stacklet's web containers now. And that's huge, because now like people that are building WordPress plugins and sites or whatever have you, I mean, like you can do that whole thing in Stacklet, right? Another, you know, like a month ago, we announced support for the WebAssembly system interface, which is effectively allows native languages to, you know, have the system interfaces you need to run, like file system access, networking, et cetera. And so we've actually got like early previews of like Python and some other things running in Stacklets. And so I think that, like, you know, you fast forward, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I think, you know, most of the world's software, I think, is going to be compiling to WebAssembly natively, just because, I mean, the performance continues to get better. The compatibility thing is huge, where it's just not having to have all these different build targets and stuff. You know, so that's like the, you know, in a nutshell, you know, our bet on WebAssembly, is the enabler of these other things starting to, you know, come online and kind of fit into this crazy new world, so to speak.
So for like you to fit these like new languages and other tools into a web container, is it like first required to go to WebAssembly so it can run in a web container? I'm not really sure on how like those two technologies mix.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So basically, and so this is the nice thing about the WebAssembly system interface is like a, you know, standardized thing through the Bytecode Alliance, which we're a part of, but it's like an open specification. So like there's a lot of tools, like you can run WASI stuff in a Cloudflare worker or on like your local machine or in Stacklets. And so the only requirement is basically you just have a, you know, a .wasm file that exposes the WASI interface to the host to actually kind of plug in and run. And so really as a language, if I let's say I'm, you know, we're like, we want to have Rust work, you know, the Rust compiler work in Stacklets, right? Really the only question is like, can we get the Rust compiler compiled to a WebAssembly binary that uses the WebAssembly system interface to, you know, do its thing? in some cases that's today can be easier said than done. And it really depends a lot on the nature of the language and how that compiler works, the runtime, if it works. So there's like specific stuff like the WebAssembly garbage collection proposal. I think that stuff's actually in Chrome behind a feature flag, or maybe it's even been unflagged. I can't remember. There's like multiple memories, which is pretty important for things that are, you know, more sophisticated. But so there's kind of these like proposals in the WebAssembly world that are going to be pretty important to get a lot of these language compilers and runtimes to be able to work properly. But this is kind of the nature of the web. Like, I think it's just the thing with like, the thing with browser APIs, like browser technology, is that it's something where you have to, the security is actually the number one thing that has to be right from day one. And that usually the trade-off here is like something that's going to be more secure is going to have robustness and performance degradations as a result, right? And so but if you give it enough time, those things actually get resolved, where you actually end up with this, you know, kind of secure by default design that actually runs at native speeds. And this is what we've seen with JavaScript engines. You know, if you kind of rewind back to the 2000s, when JavaScript was first invented, I mean, it really took 10 years, 15 years for you know, V8 to absolutely slam through the you know, the majority of the wins performance-wise you can do to make JavaScript ridiculously fast. We're maybe halfway, two-thirds of the way through the story on WebAssembly, I'd say. So I think it's I would not be surprised to see, you know, by the end of the decade, like any performance or robustness issues with WebAssembly effectively being gone at that point. And adoption, I think, you know, is going to, you know, Even with those things, it's like more and more things are going to be able to compile. And it's really more of a question, how do you get 100% coverage of all the languages out there? That's more of like a by 2030 thing. But I think every year throughout, it continues to grow.
Yeah, there really seems to be a groundswell of support behind the technology. Like the web is special because it's like, it's the one place where everybody has to go, no matter their language, and put a website up. And I think that's why like Wasm has the same kind of like excitement behind it, because it's like, oh, we're really now welcoming all of those other communities in like a first class way. Even though it might not be the fastest right now, we can work towards that.
Totally. And yeah, and it's also like a very like running an entire compiler or like runtime is a pretty heavy duty use case. Like that, there's a guy I talked to a long time ago. I can't remember who that was, but he had said like, you know, a measure of like how powerful a platform is, there's really two types of applications that that are the most intensive to run for any type of platform. One is video games, simply because the number of, you know, CPU cycles and then computation that's happening there is just incredible, right? The other one is IDEs, because it's not like it's if you're running a compiled application, that's kind of one thing, right? But then when you're actually running an entire environment that's running all of these tools that are being used to develop an application that is going to be compiled, it's actually, you know, an order of magnitude harder and like and more computation intensive typically to actually do that. And so I think in the case of WebAssembly today, it's like, you know, if you can write like, you know, our web container stuff is written with, Rust compiled to WebAssembly, and it's like crazy fast, extremely optimized, right? But like that, the 10x harder problem there is like making the Rust compiler, you know, work at that same sort of crazy speed or whatever as a WebAssembly file, right? But it's a challenge worth doing for the same reason that, you know, like going to the moon yielded a crop of technologies that you know changed everything just for everyday, you know, humans. Like duct tape, what a fantastic invention. We needed it to land people on the moon, right? So I think it's like in kind of the browser world, the browser technology world, it's like these sorts of, you know, these sorts of like crazy stress tests are really important, actually, for us to kind of aim towards and make sure they're running well, because it's the rising tide that lifts all boats, so to speak.
I'm curious about what the support story was for just like getting Node running, because I mean, that was a huge accomplishment in itself. And it wasn't clear to me like how much of that was like the community was working towards, you know, the features and functionality like gave you the leverage to, you know, connect the dots, or if it was like y'all had to invest a lot of like R&D time into like making that happen. So could you tell us a little bit more about like you know, how you got to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, the Node.js core contributors are like incredible. I mean, like Node.js in general is like an amazing project. Making it work in a browser was largely a lift on our end. Cause you know, for us, we've been very focused on like front end development kind of as the main starting use case. And so obviously Node is the primary tool that's, you know, used to run these tool chains or whatever have you. So it was like, that was the ecosystem that we had really lasered in on. And, it was extremely hard. I mean, the bulk of our work was just figuring out how to make the native parts of Node, you know, work in a browser, whether via WASM or JavaScript. And, our folks, like Dom and then the other folks that worked on the WebConnector stuff, just extremely familiar with pretty much every part of Node.js. And like, and we've ended up upstreaming, you know, a handful of different things to Node over the years as a result. But that was and continues to be actually one of the biggest, you know, parts of our work today on WebContainer.
Yeah. One really cool feature you guys have there is that you can just pop a debugger statement in a Node program and it pauses the browser debugger without any other setup. That the DX there is just amazing. Like I personally never debug my Node applications because I don't want to go look up how to do it. I'm just console log.
Totally. Yeah. And that was like, and it's funny too, because we didn't really realize that was going to be one of the like magical, you know, side effects of this thing. Cause you know, like, but it was actually, as we were building WebContainer, it kind of started to work. You know, just we kept running, you know, the earlier builds of this stuff, you can imagine a lot of stuff was breaking. And so we were like running these different, you know, tool chains with those Next.js or whatever, and something would break. And we put a debugger there and we're like, oh, right. Like this, because you're running the back end in the front end, essentially, you can put a debugger, whether it's, you know, it's kind of cool because you can actually have debuggers that are running both in your running web application, but also then in your Node application. And you're actually stepping through them linearly, right, in Chrome DevTools, which is really an experience that like, maybe there is something on local that kind of lets you do that. But like, it's the way it, I mean, you know, having that just where you're already going to do debugging in Chrome DevTools and like having it just work across the board is pretty magical. And so that, you know, that was kind of a funny one because it was just, I don't think it was really on any of our radars how amazing of a feature that was until we actually went to launch the thing. We're like, this is like one of the best features ever because we had been using it the whole development time basically. We're like, this is crazy. Like this is, you know, as you're having to build full stack apps, having full stack debugging is, you know, is key. But yeah, that is a very valuable, very interesting one.
Where have you seen Stack Blitz get the most success? Where's the product really found its home?
Good question. Yeah, I think so. For like individual developers, I mean, in the open source realm, it's had a lot of pickup in documentation or for, you know, libraries. Often it's, you know, the pain of being like a design system or like library maintainer, one that's used by a lot of people especially, is that you get all these bug reports and often they don't provide a reproducible example. And if they do give you one, it's like in a GitHub repo, which means you have to like clone that thing down, you have to install the dependencies. Like it's just a whole process, right? So often people are like, hey, provide a Stack Blitz link with every reproduction. And it just cuts down the amount of time to actually review bugs. Because a lot of times people will file a bug, it's like not actually a bug, they're just like confused. And it's like, oh, I click this thing. Okay, you're just confused. Here's another Stack Blitz like showing you how it works, right? So that's a pretty popular one. And so we ended up kind of building, we didn't really realize what we were building that, you know, at the time, but like Stack Blitz is a very classic product-led growth sort of motion. Like that's kind of the term, or community-driven sales funnel. But basically, like, you know, a lot of, you know, 2.5-3 million developers a month use stackblitz.com and they find us through open source stuff, or they're prototyping their own applications. And then out of those folks, they're just using it for their own personal purposes or whatever. Well, people are just raising their hand going, hey, I could use this at my company, right? And where we've actually found the most success has been in the Fortune 500, like companies that are pretty, you know, security conscious and et cetera, because the compute model that Stack Blitz uses is, like I was saying before about browsers, right? They have to be extremely secure. So when you open any arbitrary, web page, you're downloading third-party code and executing it on your local machine. And so for that reason, browsers have some arguably the best sandboxing technology available in the world, certainly the most well-tested. And when you go and look at enterprise companies, security matters a lot because of supply chain attacks, because of nation states that are trying to attack Western infrastructure. And this is actually a huge upgrade. Because when you open a StackBlitz link, even if it has some exploit in it, it can't, root out and, break out of the browser security sandbox. Like, this is actually a much better security model than running stuff in your own local machine. And, but it also gives you all the productivity benefits, that a web-based thing would, like, the same sort of benefits that Figma or Google Docs, like, does to, supercharge collaboration. So it's kind of a unique point in time where, like, because this browser technology has matured so much over the past decade or two, you actually have like way better productivity as a result, but also way better security. So for that reason, Fortune, the Fortune 500, 1000, whatever, they tend to really like our stuff because it kind of ticks all the boxes across the board. Whereas when you look at a lot of other solutions, it's like, if it's increasing productivity, it means there's less security. If there's more security, there's less productivity, et cetera, right? But it's all honestly really thanks to like the decades of, and billions of dollars of work that Google and Apple and Mozilla put into, making browser engines super fast and super secure.
Yeah, it's hard not to bet on web. Like, all of this, I hear about Wasm. It just makes me think that what we've done so far might become the past one day, because it just seems like a superior model. Like, you compile it once to this one universal thing. It can run anywhere. It has better security. Like, I'm very excited to see where Wasm in the web goes in the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, me too. It seems like we're on this like kind of cutting edge of a new era here that's happening. I think every decade we've kind of seen a new one of these happening, for the web. And this one is definitely crazy interesting, because it's the other thing too is like what's going on with PWAs, where you can install these things as effectively desktop apps, and that stuff just continues to get better and better. Mm-hmm. Where I think realistically, today you can do this with StackBlitz, where it removes the URL bar, it looks like a desktop app, it's indistinguishable from like local VS Code or whatever. That's where we are today. It seems to make a lot of sense that I think a lot of stuff is gonna start getting, a lot of software is gonna start getting distributed that way, where it's a web app that is being packaged and installable via your browser or whatever, But it's extremely cool times. It's been fun to watch this over the past half decade or so, from our side of the fence, and it's fun to see it hitting like maybe the early signs of like maturity. This is going to be a crazy decade, I think, for the web.
It always, like, I'm always a little bit amused to think back that like this is what Oracle was trying to do, I guess, with like Java and Javelets, and like their vision for the JVM having the kind of coverage that like Wasm has. And it's really interesting to see. He's like, okay, that definitely didn't work. There were similar ideas, but definitely different. And, to see all we've learned, and especially how we've learned, as you rightly pointed out, like there's a lot of sandboxing knowledge that's been honed over the years of like doing browser development. And now I feel like Wasm is this like, I don't know. It is this like really good target. And so I'm really fascinated about, programs that you compile them and you run them anywhere. So they're like running locally in your browser. And then it's like, oh, we got to do a lot of stuff now. We're just going to like push it up to the cloud, like very seamlessly. And you don't like see it. It's just like, it just happens. Or vice versa. It's like, you're going to run this thing in the cloud. It's like, oh no, this is fine to run in the browser. And it just like pushes it down to you, like without you really thinking about it. That model of sort of universal compute is really exciting.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I often wonder what the world would look like if Steve Jobs didn't realize he could make money off an app store. Cause the vision of the iPhone 1, I feel like we'd be in a better world if we had stuck with that.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see what's happening there too, where, it makes sense. It's been in their interest to not let other browsers write on the App Store and stuff. But I mean, I think it was just like yesterday or the day before they you know, I believe there's been a formal announcement that sideloading has to be done in the EU. I mean, and once that I would suspect that that's once that genie's out of the bottle, it's just that it's that's, you know, it's only a matter of time before that happens in the US and everywhere else. But that I think it's going to be great for the web. I think it's going to be really great for the web. We've worked a lot on making web container work in Safari, which we actually got it working earlier this year. But I mean, even there, it's just like there's just some strange decisions that are made on the Safari side. And it's just, it's very weird. I don't have a lot of direct insight, but like every release it's kind of like, you know, one step forward, one and a half or two steps backwards in some areas where like, there's just new things that are broke. And it's just this whack-a-mole thing. So I am personally excited to see, you know, Chromium and, you know, Firefox, et cetera, on iOS devices. Cause it's, you know, I think it's just going to make the power of the web, I think, finally permeate and hit on phones maybe a little bit more than it has for what you were mentioning, right? Where they've really been trying to hold this thing back. It feels like the floodgates are about to open here. So, it only took what, you know, 15 years, something.
Yeah, just a few years.
So yeah, y'all have done so much work, and, you know, having Andrew and I both have been doing web development front end stuff for a while. So we've had the joy of watching a lot of these tools mature, and like Stack Blitz really feels like magic now. Like, I mean, it's really hard to state how crazy this sort of experience is and how much that y'all have been able to accomplish. So having done all of this stuff to get to this point, what's next? What's your next magic trick? Where are y'all taking it from here?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of it, where I think we'd see ourselves 5 years from now is similar to what Figma has done for design today, where it just seems extremely kind of backwards that you would do design in some desktop tool that you can't share with a URL, right? And I think when you think about web development, at a minimum, web development, I mean, it seems kind of weird that you can't like use a web browser to build web applications today. Like, you would kind of think that like maybe that's one of the first things you ought to be able to do inside of a web browser, right? And because the benefits to that would be pretty immense. Like, I mean, a lot of the stuff we've talked about with like kind of full stack debugging, et cetera, but also the collaborative aspects where you can just send a link to someone and they're in this kind of live workspace, they'd be commenting on things, you know, making tweaks or seeing the changes live, et cetera. So I think for us, it's we've got some really interesting plans around how you can do collaboration around web development in real time and that sort of thing. And some stuff where, I mean, it's very interesting too, what's going on with AI, where you can have, it's like having an infinite number of, you know, developer partners that you can kind of kick work out to and kind of get these things back, and which fits really well with, you know, the sort of like browser-based model that we're up to. So I think those are the things that we're particularly interested in from a technology standpoint. Certainly like WebAssembly, there's like lots of interesting stuff happening there with like more languages, et cetera. So I think at a high level, it's those things. And then, you know, more than ever, you know, it's a lot of companies are picking our stuff up. And so like, I think that's, you know, we've kind of gone from this R&D experiment in a sense, like, will this work? And it's like, yes, it does. And now it's like going and helping, you know, companies around the world build better web applications faster. And so that's, you know, I think that's, you know, a big thing is, you know, our enterprise offering that you can like run behind your own firewall, et cetera. So I think that's kind of a mosh posh of, I think, the things that we're pretty excited about and like what we're thinking about.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have built a good foundation, built a good base of support, and are moving just more into teams and enterprise and that expansion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. One question we like to ask before we move on to tooltips is, what is your spiciest dev take?
I think if I had one, like the spiciest one I probably had for a while was like, you know, anyone that's not adopting Veet is probably, I guess that's maybe still true. It's like anyone that is holding out on adopting Veet as like the bundler for their framework or whatever has an extremely high likelihood of getting smoked over the next 2-3 years. and I like that. I would have said that 2 years ago. I think it's worth, and most folks are using it today, but that might be a spicy take. But I mean, there's now actually a lot of just download numbers kind of backing that up. It's the advantages of that are pretty obvious at this point. So maybe it's less spicy than it would have been, but it's maybe still like a low to medium spice.
Yeah, you guys are pretty bullish on Veet or Vite, right? You host the Vite Conf.
Yep. Yeah, and it was like back, I think it was like 2 years ago now when we first kind of ran across Veet, maybe a little over 2 years ago. But I mean, back then they were doing 100,000 downloads a week. I mean, it was pretty small. It was pretty niche. Like there's a little bit of a community, but I mean, but we had a lot of conviction on like the design decision that they used, using like the Roll-Up plugin API. And I actually wrote a blog post about this on our site when we became the biggest backer in November of 21. But I mean, since then it's grown like 10,000%, right? So it's like, it's actually been, you know, one of these like calls that, you know, ended up being really just, you know, we ended up being kind of dead on about, you know, what we thought would, you know, was really interesting and valuable about what Veet was doing. And the Veet community has been just fantastic. And so we brought on Matthias, one of the core maintainers, and we run Veet Conf every year. But yeah, I mean, it's really cool to see it grow and evolve and people building all these cool frameworks and tools around it. But yeah, so we've been part of it, maybe not from the exact beginning of the journey, but like when it was very nascent, it was a non-consensus bet at the time that this was going to be anything.
Yeah, that's cool. I've used the tool myself and it is quite fast. It's hard to go back to other things. Really push the whole industry to go, oh man, we need to make everything fast now.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I really love just the framework convergence too.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest things.
The framework convergence, everybody moving to the same tooling is highly valuable.
Yeah. And it's just like all of them working together. Right. I think that was actually one of there's like five reasons or something that we were bullish on. And that was actually one of them, which is like, it encouraged all the framework authors to work together versus inventing all of their own things, which hasn't been happening. And I think that, you know, it's kind of a flywheel effect. Once that starts happening, things are moving at such a fast rate. If you're continuing to just be off on your own island, you're having to rewrite the world, basically. It's kind of an impossible challenge. And that's like the flywheel effect is very much in full swing at this point. So that's why it's like, I think it's probably not, I don't have to be very brave, I guess, to say that, you know, it's probably a good idea for folks to switch to Veet at this point. But, you know, it's, I think there's, you know, that's about as spicy as I've got, I think, on me.
Yeah, it was a nice lukewarm take.
Love it.
Okay. And with that, let's move on to tooltips. My first tooltip of the week is a plugin for Webpack. Oddly enough, great segue. So what this plugin is a replacement for HTML Webpack plugin that does one very key thing. So like in normal Webpack, it doesn't care about HTML. You have entries that are JavaScript. And to get HTML, there's a plugin that does things to connect the things, and it's kind of hard to understand and just kind of magic in the end. What this plugin aims to do is be a lot more like a Veet and have enable you to define your entry points as HTML. So you can do the same kind of development workflow where you have like maybe a multi-page app with like five different index HTMLs that all import different JavaScript files. And what this plugin does is it helps you stitch those all together and create different outputs for each one. I literally was just trying to do this in Webpack today, and I ended up configuring our Webpack to do this for us, but it's a lot more work and I have to know about chunk names and stuff. So if you want something like the Veet experience, but not, you can't quite use Veet yet, I would check out this plugin. It's called HTML Bundler Webpack Plugin. It's a terrible name for a plugin. It's very hard to find on Google, but it looks like it has some cool features.
So you are still using Webpack?
Yeah, we are still using Webpack. We got a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of different files we load, a lot of different things we do with those files. I think we might move to RSPack, but it's still a little bit early in that project. And I hit some hurdles when I tried to move us towards that.
Were y'all using module federation in production?
No, I really want to, just like for our Electron application. Like, a big problem we have at Descript is we send a lot of updates, and for people to update their Electron app, they have to hit a button. So if we ship an update every day, they get annoyed by having to hit the button every day. So a nice thing we could do with module federation is just like ship a shell app, and then the actual app is a federated module that we just update in the background and they never know about. So I still want to do that, but I haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah. So my tooltip today is, it's more of a theme that I'm calling out. So I think, you know, we've seen these, what I'm going to classify as like meta cloud services, things like Netlify, things like Dino Deploy, who are building, a lot of times building on pre-existing infrastructure and providing sort of like cloud services to do things. And these are just two of many examples. Vercel probably would fall in this category. Something that's really interesting that I'm seeing now is they're leveraging their platforms to provide these sort of richer services like S3, like, you know, blob storage or KV stores or, you know, queuing service, you know, just all these things you can think of for AWS, but they're providing them in a way that's like, that feels pretty integrated and seamless in the platform. So I picked the Dino queues as a tooltip in a previous episode. So Netlify just launched their blob store. And then just like the other day, Steve Kraus from Valtown, who we've had on the past, also mentioned like Valtown supporting blob store. But the thing about all of these platforms is they're doing so in a way that's like, it just feels like an API call, you know, like simple, you don't have to set up a big library. It's just like import one thing, call a function. And they're just leveraging, you know, the fact that they have a lot of more contextual information about the application you're running on their platform, which lets them skip a lot of like the configuration nuance and like dealing with a lot of infrastructural stuff. So I think this trend of richer cloud integrations with like smaller amounts of configuration is going to continue to grow. And the meta platforms that are building on the bigger cloud platform providers, this is one of their sort of like strategic advantages because they're a little bit more contextual in nature. I mean, the cloud providers can obviously leverage this same sort of thing too, but I don't know. Interesting to see these two launch, and I'm like pretty fascinated to watch the whole industry go in this direction. And I think in particular, I said it before, but I'm pretty bullish on Dino. And I think they're having a really, really great approach where they're building these things, not only that they're like a native Dino, like standard library kind of thing, they're also doing it where you can host the infrastructure yourself. That's killer. So anyway, I love to see this trend. This is awesome. Anything that can make software easier to build, I think this is great. So this is cool.
Yeah, I love the simple APIs. Okay, now next up, a curse technology, Angular. Oh,
scroll this webpage. Scroll it, like, just like this thing goes so hard. Like it is. I mean, it is pretty wild. I put a tweet about it because I was like, this is like the best designed homepage I've seen of a Google product in a very long time. You know, it's like angular.dev. Like that's what it is, you know. They just did a phenomenal job on building this website. And they're actually using Web Container to power that part right there. I don't know if you're using like Safari or Firefox or something. I can't remember what the deal is with the latest Safari. They're doing something wacky. But anyways. In Chrome, it's actually really cool. I mean, it's got the you know, running live dev server and stuff. And they took a cue from what Rich Harris did with learn.svelte.dev. But this is probably the most beautiful doc site I think I've ever seen. The way they laid it out is very cool with like interactive tutorials. So I just want to just point that out because it's like kind of ridiculous how well done that website is. So angular.dev, I think that's like the new homepage for Angular or whatever have you.
I really need to check into what they've been doing. Angular feels like such a moat. It's like they have a lot of loyal developers, but they have like a pretty dedicated community, and they don't cross-pollinate as much. So I feel like when I'm, you know, talking to people that do like Svelte or React or you know, even like Quick and like a bunch of the new stuff, they're all kind of like in the same arena sometimes, but like Angular folks are just like over here, like doing their thing, shipping software.
17 major versions deep.
Yeah. Well, it's incredible. I mean, after the whole AngularJS to Angular 2 switch thing, they haven't had like really breaking changes in any of this stuff, as far as I'm aware. Like it's been a, you know, so a lot of enterprise companies use Angular, you know, for this reason, because it's just consistent. Like they're very, very consistent. So yeah, it's super interesting, but it was a cool one. And I think the other things I picked were vConf, which is like, I've actually been like playing through, you know, vConf was like 12 hours of talks. Yeah, so it's like it's quite a gauntlet to sit through in one sitting, which I was not able to do. But I've been actually listening to all the talks now, and it's pretty cool. Like it's the replay is pretty well done. Like I think up at the top there's like a link for it or whatever, but it's all broken out, and you know, all the live examples are runnable within the site or whatever from the talks. But yeah, so anyways, been a lot of fun kind of watching vConf. You know, and kind of rewinding what folks were saying there.
My next tool tip is Next-Video. It's a way to add video to your Next.js application. It's built on top of the technologies that Mux puts out. So it does a lot of cool things like optimizing the video streaming. It supports like HLS and Quick and posters and all the different things that you'd want with a video service. The cool part about it, though, is that it's almost like a pages directory for your videos. So what they suggest that you do is you create a videos directory in your next project. You git ignore that and then like git LFS the videos so that they don't make your repo bigger. And then what they suggest you do is run this script that as you add videos to that, they upload those videos to the platform. So it's just like kind of, it feels like you're managing it within your repo, but you really kind of aren't. It's like just integrating with their platform. So if you're looking to integrate video with your app, you might want to give this a try. I've been hearing a lot of good things about Mux, and they seem to put out pretty good stuff.
That's pretty cool. Video is non-trivial. It's not easy. So that's awesome.
Next up, we have Image.
On the note of videos and maybe photos, something that I've been talking to some friends about recently is like it's like hard to find a good photo and video like backup tool for, you know, like you're using on your phone. So it's like if you're on Apple, you can use iCloud, or, you know, if you're on an Android, you can use Google Photos or something. But maybe that's not what you want to do. Maybe you want to self-host something. So Image is just this project that I found on GitHub. Which is, yeah, doing that. They're just like making a self-hosted photo and video backup tool. And it seems pretty cool. It's like looks pretty high quality, open source. So, I mean, you can play with it. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, I feel like definitely we push a lot of our data up to the cloud. And like sometimes it's nice to have, you know, actual physical copies of these things. And hopefully still have a good like user experience around it. And these have apps that come with them, and the apps look pretty good too. So if you need a solution for that, check it out.
Yeah, I run a similar thing on my NAS, I think. I don't use it very much, but it exists there. Last up, we have Remix.
I don't know what's in the water over Shopify, but like these guys are on fire. I mean, like they are like, this is, Remix is really, it seems like it's really turning into like a very serious React framework. I mean, Shopify's, you know, apparently using it, right? Like, you know, they're kind of switching all their stuff over to Remix, but and they also just like you know, they've done this like kind of rewrite of, they have their own kind of custom compiler thing, and they've, you know, they're migrating over to Vite, which is pretty cool because it makes adopting Remix something you can do like very incrementally if you're on like React Router or something like that. And that's a pretty big deal, because I mean, like, we've got stuff at Stacklets on like React Router or whatever, and then lots of things over the years. And so people that are on like Create React app or on like Vite or like some, you know, custom Webpack plus React Router thing, I mean, this is going to be, I think it's going to be like a pretty big deal. I mean, like a incremental path where you can just, you know, add it to your Vite config, and, you know, suddenly you've got SSR stuff, you know. They're doing a really good job. So I wanted to give a shout out there. So I've had a lot of fun playing around with Remix.
Yeah, Shopify made a bet on Ryan and Michael, and I don't think that was a very risky bet. It's been cool to see what they've been able to do with like a company backing. Before, like they were just kind of just some guys teaching React and like doing nice React libraries in their side time. Now that it's their main focus, it's really exciting to see the progress that they've made.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think them going to Shopify with like ended up being. I mean, it appears it has been a very great decision. I mean, on both parties, because having it be not tied to like having to be monetized or something like that. I mean, it's just really allowed them to focus on building something that's great, you know, and that's great to use at any type of company, and it's cool. So I'm excited to see where Remix goes. I think they're a pretty serious contender at this point, in my view, for if you're building React applications. So I'm excited to play around more with the stuff Remix is putting out.
Yeah, at Oxide, we have a bunch of Remix apps for all of our internal stuff and our public-facing site. And then the like web UI on the Oxide racks is like a Remix-like spa. But they're actually coming out with a single-page app mode for Remix soon. So when they come out with that, we'll probably just switch over entirely. So really excited about that. That'd be cool.
Wow, I didn't even know that. That's going to be a big deal. I think that'll be a game changer.
Well, that's it for tooltips this week. It was a lot of fun having you on, Eric, talking about your crazy pass at AOL and all the crazy stuff you guys are doing with Wasm and web containers today. It was a lot of fun. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great chatting with you all.
Yeah, so good to have you, Eric. And also, like, StatBlitz is an absolute treasure. I mean, I love anytime I go to the documentation page and I like see live examples that I can play with. So appreciate all the work that you do. And yeah, just wish y'all luck.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on. This has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate it. It's good stuff.